The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hello, my name is Shengfu Lerlo. I'm from Great Neck, New York and Northway Health. Here we're today with two world experts today, Dr. Daniel Shula and Dr. Joshua Abman, spinal tumors. And we're going to talk about the role of radical surgery in this modern spinal oncology era. So the first question I have for the both of you is, starting off with the primaries, how do you think about these radical surgeries that are quite intensive in order to try to get negative margins for these surgeries in terms of the role for these big operations?
I think it's a great question. You know, a lot of it comes from, in some ways, the orthopedic literature, and Dr. Schwab can comment on this, where we've seen, at least with primary malignant tumors, there is a benefit in the patients that don't respond well to other forms of treatment, radiation and chemo, that traditionally it was key to get the whole tumor out and ideally the whole tumor with a margin. Anything on top of that has been more a little bit more complex and a little bit more refined in terms of radiation before or after, but that's really where it came from. The issue that comes up is that in the spine, at least for these tumors that don't respond as well to radiation or chemo that are malignant, is you can't take off a foot or an arm because it actually is more nuanced around the spinal cord. So it leads to very complex surgeries. And as a result, I think a lot of us in the field have shied away from these complex surgeries, hoping that we can do smaller surgeries. And I will just tell you, at least in my practice, that still sometimes is not the right call. They still need radical surgeries for some of these because they still do recur. And then you're on your back foot because you're trying to fix things. So I think there's still a great role for radical surgeries, many ones where you take the tumor out in one piece or with negative margins, in these primary malignant tumors.
Yeah, I agree. I think, as you alluded to, one of the pioneers of doing these larger surgeries, whether it be, you know, en bloc sacrectomies or spondylectomies, was a surgeon from Sweden, Bertil Stenner. And he wrote to me, was a very important paper along with Björn Gunterberg. And they published this paper in the early 80s. And it had something like 52 patients. And all these patients had subtotal resections. This was prior to the era of doing more aggressive surgeries. And these were very good, very experienced surgeons. And they were trying to remove all the tumor. They were meticulous in the sacrum. And a lot of these patients also had radiation. And at that time, they got up to, say, 40 gray of radiation. I don't think anybody got more than 40 gray. And what happened? Well, they followed those patients for a minimum of 8 years, which really you could only do in a place like Sweden where they have this federal system. But all the patients recurred, except for one. Only one patient didn't have disease at the end there. And so what does that mean? Okay, you had a recurrence. What does it really mean? Well, what it really means is that those recurrences then continue to grow. And what happens to the patients? They lose their bowel function. They lose their bladder function. They lose their sexual function. The tumors continue to grow after that. The tumors fungate out of the skin. They get infected. They become septic and they die. And it takes a long time of suffering for that to happen. And I say that because that to me is what must have given Dr. Stenner the courage to say, we need to be much more aggressive. If someone comes into your office and they have normal function and you're going to tell them, we're going to take all your function, how can you do that? How can you justify that? He could justify that because he sees what happens if he didn't do that. And we don't see that as much now. And I think sometimes we lose sight. So I agree with you. There is a role for it, but it does come down to talking to the patients about, you know, what it will mean to go undergo a surgery like that.
Got it. So this is a little bit more provocative, but I feel like the general trend in surgical specialties is to go less invasive. We're trying to be less morbid in terms of these operations, and especially with the newer treatments for the cancer in terms of molecular targeted therapy, immunotherapy, potentially even carbon ion, heavy ion radiation coming to the United States. How do you think that affects the role of radical surgery in these days?
It's a great question. I will tell you that, you know, sometimes I put patterns on things that don't exist, but the one pattern I've put more recently in my mind is that I'm seeing in my own practice and across the field that it's becoming a bimodal. So rather than having a bell-shaped curve where we all are just a gradient of one thing, I'm seeing things break into two. I'm seeing more deformity surgeries in spine that are correcting every aspect of the patient's alignment and fusing almost their entire mobile spine into the pelvis. And then I'm seeing endoscopic surgery done for a disc where the patient's in a procedure for 15 minutes and they go home. And maybe less of the middle stuff, which we grew up on, the open laminectomy infusion. You're saying, if it's tiny, treat it tiny. And if it's big, treat it big. And I would put that on top of tumors as well. So, for example, in the patient who is riddled with tumors and has a poor functional status, which means they might not even be capable of having chemotherapy, which is maybe less, even less risky to them than surgery, we are saying give them a pain management treatment that is maybe even at home, you know, maybe not even coming to a procedure type base. But then on the patients we think can live a long time, as Dr. Schwab was commenting on, and they're going to come back and I'm going to say, wait a second, we are dealing with a runway of 30 years. Now you're thinking like a deformity surgeon. This has to be thought out, planned, strategized. It really has to be a robust fix versus I got to get this patient out of pain for the next 3 months. Maybe the patient is very sick. I think it's breaking the two things. So although one or the other, maybe was the question that was posed to me, I would say part of the strategy has to be very early on, whether it's experience from the surgeon, a multi-D group, a AI algorithm, learning from other fields and saying, what is the best for this person's runway? Now, we can't predict. We're not deterministic. It's still stochastic. It's still flipping a coin. I might have a prediction that I might live 15 years with my tumor and then I get hit by a bus and that was wrong. But given most of the odds, if this is a long-term player, I am suggesting larger operations, more comprehensive treatment plans. And then I'm also sitting there saying to a patient, I am going to not be here that long and I want to have the best quality of life. Please don't hang out with me having a big surgery. Go home and we'll do something more minimally invasive. So I think both are essential. I think we're getting better at big surgeries and I think we're getting better at small surgeries. And I think they can be done simultaneously.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think, and sometimes it's very difficult because the long toward effects of the treatment that we render may not be felt for quite a while. And so we're in the immediate aftermath of a procedure, a very large operation. Everyone knows it. The patient knows it the most, and we also feel it. And so some people shy away from that. They may do a smaller operation out of principle of doing a smaller operation, but that may lead to a larger problem down the road. And so it is a balancing act. And I don't know that I have it all figured out yet. That's for sure. And I do also agree with what you're saying, that some people have a particular niche and they have a surgical technique, say an endoscopic approach. They become very, very good at that. And they have not focused on their open approaches, their osteotomies, things, and they become less comfortable with it, and vice versa. And so then things start to become categorized under what you're comfortable managing. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is I think natural to happen, but is in some way a detriment.
Got it. Then transitioning nicely to, I think a lot of the early discussions have been having a focus on primary tumors, but do you think that same argument holds for metastatic cancer, where perhaps it's a solitary met to the spine, perhaps the histology is favorable for potentially long-term survival, perhaps like an EGFR mutant lung cancer or something like that. How do you think you would approach that in this day and age where traditionally we've always thought about separation surgery for these, but now there seems to be some newer data from the radiation oncology literature that even within separation surgery and histology, that there actually seems to be some histology dependence even for SBRT.
Yeah, I think the first thing I'd respond to that is the talks I gave 10 years ago, hopefully they're a little different now. I think they are. But those talks were truly, maybe a false dyad of metastatic you treat like this and primary malignancy you treat like this. And it's a totally different recipe. Stick with this and stick with that. Well, there are some primaries that progress very rapidly. You know, I think of an osteosarcoma. You're trying to do an en bloc and the next thing you know, it's in the lungs and you're sitting there going, well, this was an en bloc. I was trying to cure this patient, but it's very rapid. On the other hand, as you allude to, there can be an oligometastatic patient, oligo meaning few, and it depends on who you talk to what few is. Is it 1, 2, 3? It could go all the way in the brain. People call 10 oligometastatic sometimes. But you sit there and say, what if you have pretty good systemic control of your soft tissues with, say, a renal cell, but you have one lesion, and if you do a separation with radiation, it just keeps coming back. Well, now you're not doing the patient a service by saying, hey, you're metastatic. This is purely palliative. If the patient's around for 15 years and has 15 surgeries on their spine, one a year, that would not be the right approach. So I would think that as we start thinking about this, some of the tools you suggested, some of the predictive based on their genetics, some of the predictive based on their frailty, some of the predictive based on their response to chemotherapy, maybe it's not a metastatic versus a primary malignant. Maybe it's a planned out likelihood of whatever this person is going to do with this type of tumor. That's how you treat the strategy of treatment rather than just simply saying left or right. And I think we have to be a little more sophisticated.
No, I agree. And I think what we don't have yet is the ability to bin the tumors accurately. You know, we have the histologic bin, and then you may have an EGFR marker or a few other markers, but we need many more of those markers. Once we have them, and it can help us say this person is not going to do as well with stereotactic, then you treat it in a different way. And we're not there yet, I think, but I completely agree with you. That's where we're headed.
A lot of the predictive modeling that you've done as part of your research, some of that is focused on metastatic tumors. How do you think we refine on that to become even more accurate in the future so that we can potentially predict the subpopulation of patients that might actually benefit from a more radical resection up front in the metastatic patient?
Well, I mean, one of the things we've had to do is we've had to evolve the algorithms, right? So some of our patients were living longer. For instance, some of the patients with lung cancer are living quite a bit longer, especially right. You know, if they respond to a checkpoint inhibitor, for instance. Whereas before, it was 3 months, you know, 3 to 6 months, and right. That was pretty reliable. Now some of these patients are living for years. And so depending upon what they're susceptible to, they're in a different category. And so adapting those predictive models is something that we are doing, but it's not going to stop because we're going to continue to develop ways to understand the tumors, what markers the tumors provide, and what they're susceptible to. So those are moving targets. Any algorithm we develop has to be changed, has to keep growing.
Got it. And sort of one last question for you, Dr. Shuba, is that as we think about trying to minimize the patient trauma, tissue trauma for these radical operation, potentially even offering them to the metastatic patient, what do you see on the horizon in terms of evolution and surgical technique, perhaps anesthetic things that could potentially make these surgeries less intense for the patient?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, things that we always think things happen in linear, but really they happen in steps. And maybe from far away it looks linear, but really it is steps. And I think that we have to continue to communicate amongst each other. As Dr. Schwab was alluding to, you might be set in your ways as a surgeon. I definitely am set in my ways as a surgeon. And I see things through, you know, a certain carpentry that I do. And I find out that maybe I can accomplish the same goals through a corridor that I'm not familiar with. That has to be educated to me for either to say, you should see someone who does that corridor, or I should incorporate that. And then we should study it. Because, you know, theoretically, these are these patients' lives. And we can't be theoretically saying, you know, in my experience, I've done this 100 times. And it always is a B+. But that's what you get. We have to use techniques, whether it's local anesthetic techniques, as you were using some certain techniques or making people respond better. We have liposomal anesthetic that makes people feel less pain. We have scopes that can look around corners. We have more minimally invasive two-stage approaches. So it used to be, you know, a big incision in the front, a big incision in the back. And now the question is, can you do something a little bit more minor in the front and minimally invasive in the back, and then big in the back, or small in the back and big in the front, deliver these specimens? But the key is that we have to communicate to each other, and then we have to communicate to the patient, because they're the ultimate decider, at least still currently in this society that we live in, they still get to make that decision. And I think that giving them more information is better, because as I alluded to, if you tell a patient you can have 10 surgeries in 10 years, but each one's small, If you just tell them the first surgery you're going to do is small, they say, sign me up. If you say, but the big surgery in front might actually be half the size of 10 small surgeries, they're going to be thoughtful about this. So part is communication, part is learning from each other.
All right. I'm going to wrap up here. Thanks both of you so much for your time.